Welcome to Gluck Radio. I am Dr. Errol Gluck, executive life coach and master problem solver. Today I'm joined by Christine Barnett. Christine's son Jake was diagnosed as a severe autistic. But for Jake, that resulted in something quite extraordinary. Jake has an IQ higher than Einstein, was a master student at the age of 14, and was solving problems before puberty that world-class astrophysicists could not. Right now, Jake is actually working on an original theory that many physicists say put the young teenager on track to win the Nobel Prize. Though Jake is the object of fascination, we're going to be talking to Christine about her book, Spark, which tells us what it means to be the mother of someone who could see the universe in his head, but has trouble with basic conversation. How did Christine help Jake, make Jake become an important and amazing contributor to humanity when doctors predicted he would never even speak? How did she feed his voracious appetite for knowledge and concepts while still ensuring he got to play sports and make friends? It's a story that is both spooky and awe-inspiring, and I am so proud and happy to have her on our show. Christine, welcome. This is just such a fascinating story. So before we go to the beginning, tell us how old Jake is now, and what now is a typical day like for him?
Jacob is now 15 years old, and he is a graduate student at an Advanced Institute for Theoretical Physics, which is called Perimeter Institute here in Waterloo, Canada.
He's a graduate student at 15 for theoretical physics.
He's one of the youngest students in their class, and he is just having an awesome time. Perimeter Institute has just been this wonderful, wonderful, rich environment full of people collaborating, and it's just been great.
Now, we're going to ask more about that later, but I want to take you back a little bit in history, okay?
Okay.
So, Christine, Jake was premature. How premature was he? And the doctors predicted that both you and Jake wouldn't even live. By the way, did they tell you that before or after?
Well, what's funny is they did not tell me. So I went into preterm labor with Jacob in my third trimester, and I was able to hold on to him until he was a weight that was sufficient for him to be born. But during the delivery, there were just so many complications, and they told my husband, Michael, at the time, that he would either be going home with a wife or with a baby, but probably not both. And I was not aware of that, but I was aware that things were just not going right. There were just too many people in the room. It just, you know, but having my first baby, I really didn't know what to expect.
We should know the name of that cheery doctor, but you don't have to say it. So what actually happened? You came home with him, and what were the early signs that something was different with Jake?
Well, what was wonderful was when we came home and we were both home, we were out of the woods. We thought here was this difficult end of pregnancy, and now we had this beautiful baby boy who was laughing and giggling and just doing everything a typical little baby would do, and it was miraculous to us. So he did quite well at first, but then around 16 months of age, he started to regress into his own world, really. And he was diagnosed with moderate to severe autism.
So he was diagnosed with moderate to severe autism. Okay. Did they see at that point any gifting in him? Were they just threw him in the classification of moderate to severe autism?
Well, it's interesting. He had a psychologist from the school come out and evaluate him. And he was able to do these puzzles that she was doing at a very, very rapid pace. We did see that, but there were so many issues that he had to work on, things like making eye contact. And these were skills that a two-month-old baby had that Jacob didn't have going into his second birthday. So we were so focused on those that where his IQ had come back very high, startlingly high on the test. Nobody mentioned it. It wasn't something that anybody really paid attention to.
It's interesting that we're prone to look for that which is normal, and we avoid or miss that which is extraordinary. What was the most impressive thing that Jake did before the age of four?
Well, at 3 years old, I took him to a planetarium, and we had really just gone to look at Mars. At this time, he was pretty autistic and wasn't functioning very well around crowds, and so I was quite nervous to actually be taking him to the planetarium just because of the crowd, but I knew he wanted to look at Mars. And there was a lecture before you could go and see Mars up through the telescope, and whereas I was just looking around in my bag for stickers or gummy bears or Cheerios, anything that might entertain this toddler until he could see Mars, he surprised me by sitting very, very still in the lecture. And a few minutes in, he began to shout out, which, of course, horrified me as a parent. Here we are in this very sophisticated college-level lecture, and he's shouting out words. But the words were things like perihelic and very complicated words, and the crowd started to notice him. And I thought they were kind of disturbed that here's this child possibly disrupting the lecture. But actually, what they had noticed that I actually didn't even notice was he was reading these words off of the slides. And then at the end of the lecture, the professor asked a question about the moons going around Mars. And he said, "The moons going around Mars are shaped like potatoes. Does anybody know why?" And Jacob raised his hand and said to the professor, "Excuse me, what are the sizes of these moons relative to the planets?" And the professor said, "Well, they're very, very small." And Jacob said, "Well, then in that case, the mass of the moons and planet and the gravity," I still don't understand this concept to this day, "but was not sufficient to pull the moons into a round shape." And all of us just sort of stared at the professor and at Jacob. And then the professor said, "The little boy's cracked."
The little boy's cracked. It sounds like the professor was cracked. They didn't notice the fact that he had a gift?
Yeah, at that time. Then people were very, very surprised that he got that answer right. That was pretty much the first thing I noticed that was startling about Jacob.
So it came a little bit right away. His early autism, when he was 1, 2, 3, 4, up until that point, how did the autism, first of all, act? How was his autism expressed? And how did you react to the fact that you now had an autistic child? What was going on in your head?
Well, I'm really glad for the way you asked that question, because autism is a spectrum disorder. So people on the autism spectrum are not all exactly the same. And that's important to know. For Jacob, he had a sense of order about the world around him that I knew was a sense of order. But a lot of the therapists saw the things he was doing as perseverative types of behavior. So he would go off into the corner away from people, and he would stack things, he would line things up, he would take string and wind it around the room. And one of the things that I noticed was when he did this, he never made a mess. And he was a 2-year-old boy. So I was running a little daycare at the time, and whereas all the other toddlers were sort of rough and tumble, toppling over each other and knocking down block towers, Jacob, he never, ever made a mess. And everything that he did seemed to me to have some sort of purpose. But when it came to the therapists who were out at the house working with him, they just saw it as an isolated type of play, a repetitive type of behavior, and they would take the things that he was playing with away from him.
It seemed like you had much greater insight than the people around you, which is quite often. I would tell every mother, you know, her instincts, all because someone is a professional and has a degree, doesn't mean that they have any more intuitive knowledge, instinctual knowledge, than someone who really cares and is looking at the child through very, very specific eyes. And you obviously had those eyes to see him. Did you fire the therapist at that point? Did you go on your own? What happened after that?
Well, I didn't fire the therapist, but I did. The thing is, when you're diagnosed with autism, the prognosis is so very bleak, and we were told Jacob would probably never speak to us again, probably need lifelong assistance. And so we were put in this thing called early intervention, which was hours and hours and hours, 40 to 60 hours a week, full-time days of working on deficits Jacob had, like stacking cups, walking upstairs 1 foot after each other. And one day while running this little daycare that I had, I took the children out into a spring morning. They all went out into the grass and they were playing in the sprinkler and they were just splashing each other and running around. And they had this childhood curiosity and wonder. And they were just, I noticed the contrast between these typical children and my son, who was still sitting at the therapy table, not responsive and pretty much falling asleep at the table. And I realized we hadn't really made any progress doing the typical therapy in almost a year. And so that very night, I decided to just focus on Jacob's childhood. At the time, I didn't know what I was doing, but I realized that if we continued this schedule of therapy, I very likely might forget his childhood.
Now, you had an epiphany. You did know what you were doing. You just didn't know why you were doing it.
Maybe. It just, and this is something that, you know, people thought I was crazy. They thought, you know, oh my gosh, she's missing her therapy hours, going off with this little boy and building sandcastles. And, but you know, I think that's the thing as a mom, as a parent, we see our kids struggling in something. It might be math. They might be the kid on the sports team that's not doing well. Whatever it is, all of us parents, you know, we have this in common. And when we see something that's just kind of not right and we get this feeling about it, we're the ones who can jump in and make a difference for our kids. And it takes a tremendous amount of courage because from the outside, people might not understand why we're doing the things we're doing. But you just get a feeling, and those instincts are important to pay attention to.
But you did something even more brilliant from my perspective. You focused on what he could do as opposed to what he couldn't do. So you weren't looking on the pimple on his nose. You were looking at this guy has some unusual abilities that no one is actually picking up. Jake liked confined spaces. He liked closets. He liked cabinets. What was that all about?
I think that for him, he does have issues, even to this day, with his sense of his space in the room. So for him to go into like a tiny cabinet or underneath of a chair or table, to him that just sort of closed the space in around him so he could really feel where he was in space and then focus in on the things that he wanted to think about. But we would often find him like in laundry baskets and cabinets all over in our house and little in the bathtub with blankets, just silly things like that.
You know what? You know what? It's actually no different than anyone else. And this is what I mean by that. Christine, people need to feel safe before they could actually think and create. You know, when a person doesn't feel safe, then what they're doing is skating through life. So your son created a world around him that he could immediately feel safe and then take off in his mind and create.
I really appreciate you saying that. I don't know. That's wonderful for me to understand. You know, what I think is another thing to say here is that when you notice something like that and it looks a little different or awkward, like why is he in a bathtub with four blankets and teddy bears reading a book? You know, a lot of people would take him out of there. A lot of people would take away the thing like him spinning a ball around for hours. And to me, that's really, really sad because this person has obviously expressed that this is what they need. And we need to value that.
Absolutely. And even more than that, it's not only that he expressed what he needs, but that he, what he needs is in order for him to develop his individuality, his individual greatness. And people make this one major mistake. They always think that everyone should have or think the way they do. Big mistake. Now, I'm changing subjects for a second. Your second son after Jake was Wes. He was born with a rare nervous system disorder that doctors predicted would kill him before the age of one. You have the most depressed doctors I've ever heard of, okay? Where do you find them? Between Jake's autism and Wes's disorder, how did you deal with it? How did you deal with the news of one child is autistic and the other one is predicted to die before he's one? And well, he didn't die, correct?
No, he very, very happily and luckily he made it through that. But he did have a disorder that affected the things that his body did automatically. So like breathing, swallowing, not aspirating liquids. So like he'd take a drink and it would go directly into his lungs. So he had some significant challenges early on in life. And I think one thing to note is that there are no super moms. You know, I went through this time where I had two little boys who were very, very sick, and I was running a daycare. And people will say, wow, well, that's just incredible that you did all of that. And I'm the first person to say, I was in the shower at night crying and devastated. And there are no real super moms. But when you get through some major challenges in life and you look back and you think, how did I get through them? One of the things that I did do that I know saved me and my kids at the time is I reached out to the community around me. So I found other people who are going through similar things, and I created a charity called Jacob's Place, and I helped them. And by doing that, I actually helped myself because I was communicating with the other moms. We could see what was going on with each of our kids and compare them. And I found out that sometimes a group of five moms can be better than a visit to a doctor or therapist. So it was surrounding myself with a supportive community that lifted me up and not forgetting other people, that there were other people out there going through the same struggles I was, and we could do it together.
Christine, that's why I disagree with you. That's why you are a supermom. Because a supermom is not someone who could do it herself. A supermom is someone who looks at the problem and says, what do I need to fix it? And you needed other people, and you got other people. So in my book, you are a supermom.
Oh, goodness, thank you.
So tell me about this daycare center. What was the general philosophy of the school? Now, this was just for the autistic children, correct?
At the beginning of the school, it was typical children. But what happened right around the time Jacob was diagnosed with autism, there was a huge wave of children in our country, in the U.S. at least, that were all diagnosed with autism pretty much at the same year. So if you look at incident rate charts and things like that, they're just crazy increase in percentage of autism that year. So other children who started coming to me, they were also losing skills. And I did happen to have one other little boy in the daycare who was also diagnosed with autism. And so the school shifted. It started taking in more children with autism, but the principles of the school remain the same from when I had just worked with typical children. And my philosophy with all children is to surround them with this thing I call muchness.
Muchness.
Yes.
Okay.
Like very technical.
I like
term
that.
There.
No, I like that. Muchness. So tell me about muchness. How much is muchness?
Muchness is a lot, let me tell you. When I was growing up, I had a younger sister who was very, very good at art. And she could create these elaborate worlds around us with just a stack of paper. She would take a stack of paper, fold it back and forth, and create three-dimensional trees, and we would sit under them. She would create animals, and it was amazing growing up with her. I would tell the stories, and she would do the artwork, and that was how we played. We really didn't play with toys even as little kids. So I sort of, from my upbringing, brought that into the way that I dealt with the children in my world. And what I did was I would find what they were interested in, nothing they were struggling with. I kind of didn't worry about that. I found the thing that they were interested in, and I built everything around it so that it became the whole environment. And it was so fascinating. It had to be so fascinating that it made them motivated to learn more about that thing. So in my book, you can't just take a child with art that is fascinated with art and give them some books on Monet. Instead, you need to take the entire room, put some tarp down, open up the paints, put canvases all around, even on the ceiling, and just go at it. So muchness, it means everything around you. A kid with trains, somebody who loved to play with trains, we would all work together to build a working steam engine in the middle of the room. A kid who loved animals, I would actually go to the farm and bring in snakes. I would bring in ducks. I would bring in llamas. You know, and you can imagine my husband coming home to this kind of thing because the daycare was in our house.
He probably thought it was dinner. But
I
got to tell you,
there was a llama
and you don't think
table.
You're a supermom?
I find that to be very funny at that time. But yes, muchness, sometimes you get yourself into some crazy situations.
Let me tell you again, to your own embarrassment, why you are a supermom, okay? Every single parent makes the same mistake. They try to create the child in their image. They try to project the values of what they want the child to be. You're looking at the child and you're saying, who are they, and help, and let me help develop that. That is so advanced. That is so super momish. I'm actually calling you SM from now.
Oh my goodness. You are embarrassing me. But you know what? This is so true. I have worked with a lot of kids through the years, and parents have expectations, and a lot of times they reflect things that they've seen in their life. So a parent who's a lawyer, you know, they'll want to get their kid into debate class, or a parent who's an accountant, you know, they'll try to take them to chess class. But we need to look at them, because they're not necessarily going to have the same interests as you. But the thing is, the thing that makes them happiest in life, the thing that they're wanting to do, that creates motivation. So then you have the kid who comes home and you don't have to tell them to do their homework. They come home and they're building a laboratory in the house. It's amazing what happens when you drop your expectations and you let them do what they love.
Something you said actually made me not only pause, but it actually made me sit still, and I never sit still. You said tantrums aren't a symptom of autism, but a symptom of the failure to understand autism. Now, I got it, but I want you to explain to our audience.
Well, I think when a child is having a tantrum, they're expressing to you that something in their world is not right. And what we do is we look at that behavior and we're alarmed at it, and so we try to mediate that behavior. And instead, we sort of just need to understand the child, understand how they're learning. And so when I did my charity with kids with autism, I would literally have 20 kids in a class at a time that all had autism. And what I would do is, before they came in, I would look at the environment around and think about how each one of them would respond to that, and I would sort of adapt it. And the kids would work together. So when they would come in, instead of just saying, everybody sit down, I would put out a big parachute, and I'd put all sorts of things that they could hold on there, things that they could look at, like little liquid in different jars, all sorts of sensory items there. And by doing that, they all just came in and they were drawn to the parachute and they'd all sit in a circle. Other people would be working for hours and hours to get kids to sit in a circle, but it didn't work because people were not understanding what the kids needed to sit in the circle. And so if we understand how these kids think, and we don't understand, and we don't think about how do we want them to think, then they just don't have tantrums. It's kind of interesting.
It is more than interesting. I always tell my clients that the first rule of communication is you play catch, not tennis. Always try to understand before you insist on being understood. And that's exactly what you do. You always understand first. and you're not projecting your own understanding. You want to understand from the child. Again, Supermom, you keep on doing it. So everyone's on their edge of their seat. What happened to Jake's talents at the ages of 8, 9, and 10? Where did he explode to intellectually?
So this little boy I had went off to grade school and surprised everybody because with autism, he was able to go into a mainstream classroom and do well. So the work I had done before he was 5, it worked out. And then the sad thing, though, was the school system could not keep up with the pace of his mind. And in first, second, and third grade, he was asking them, I want to learn algebra. I want to learn algebra, repeatedly asking that, and he couldn't learn it until later in junior high or high school. So he became frustrated, and he became bored. And he came home, and he started sneaking off to these little corners of the house again and closing himself in and creating these things. And I decided to take him back to the planetarium like I had when he was little. And then the planetarium closed for the year. So the only other place I had to go was the local university, which had a class on Saturn. And I wasn't going for the class on Saturn. I wasn't going because it was a university. This wasn't like I expect Jacob to do college. I didn't expect that at all. I just wanted him out of the bathtub again and participating in our world. So our expectation was if he can sit in the back of the class and not interrupt it, he can look at the slides. And that's all we thought was going to happen. But what actually happened, at 8 years old, Jacob started participating, to all of our surprise, in this class on Saturn. He did a group project with the group, took all the tests, and took the final and aced it, got perfect scores on all of that stuff. And then the professor noticed that the questions he was asking were very, very intriguing questions, which are at the forefront of science today, and invited him to attend an electromagnetic physics course at 9 years old. And so by 12 years old, Jacob had published his own original work in theoretical physics.
And at 12 years old.
12 years old, and he got a world record for being the youngest person to ever be published in Physical Review A for his theoretical physics.
So everyone out there who thinks you know what autism is, you don't.
Okay. Thank you.
Now, you didn't need a GPS in your car, and the reason being because your son memorized the maps of the entire country.
This story, yes. When he was a little boy, he loved trains. He loved maps. And he would take popsicle sticks, and he would make maps all over our floor, Q-tips or little bits of anything that he could do, and he would make an identical map to wherever we had traveled. And so at 3 years old, he was actually able to navigate around busy cities like downtown Chicago just by memorizing the map.
Unbelievable. I need a GPS to get from my bedroom to my bathroom.
I will admit, I still use Jacob for my directions. I'm not very good at that. I'm one of those people that says turn at the bush with the pretty red flowers on it. So he's been helpful.
Yeah, you know, I love those people. I grew up in the city. They say turn southwest at the big boulder. Like, I know what southwest is. All right. So let me ask this question. Jacob in his development. Now, he is how old right now?
Jacob's 15 years
He's
old.
He's 15. Right? Is there, you know, is there a sense of, does he interact with other people? Does he think about dating or romance? Is there any sexual development that you see or sexual interest? How is he developing in those areas?
Okay, well, I guess he's not here, so I guess.
Yeah, you could tell it all.
Okay, so, yeah, Jacob, he's had several girlfriends now, and he has his second girlfriend, and she's really sweet. She's a really nice girl, and so he's just seemed to be a pretty typical teenager. I think we've kept things focused on Jacob just having a regular, typical life. We've kept kids around his age. We've kept our home life very simple and very just typical. In fact, moving here, we decided to move to a farm just for all of those experiences to get to be around animals, and we have St. Bernards and stuff like that. But as far as being a teenager, you know, once Jacob was able to talk to us about the things that he was passionate about, which for him happens to be physics and mathematics, it sort of opened this door where then he could talk to the rest of the world. And one of my proudest moments of Jacob is not the science and math that he's done, although they're amazing, but one of my proudest moments was when Jacob gave a TEDx talk in New York on Broadway and spoke in front of hundreds of people, because I realized this thing that he loves translates into him talking to the rest of the world. And so, yeah, now he's just a regular teenager, plays squash, goes surfing, plays hockey and football.
So he is anything but a regular teenager. What he is, you know, is he's a super teenager. He plays all the sports, and from what I understand, his IQ tested higher than Einstein's.
Yeah, he's had his IQ tested about 4 times now with different tests, and he does top them out. So basically, there's a limit at the top end of the test, and when you get to there, you can't really determine anything else. So I wish I had that kind of IQ. It's amazing the things he can do. But I think that even without IQ, you know, a lot of the kids that I worked with still repeated this sort of success, because the whole key is motivation. So I had kids with just average IQs who turned out building computers in their basement, going to architecture internships over in Europe, starring in plays. It's really not about how very, very smart you are or whether you're going to be an astrophysicist. It's about, are you doing what you love? Because that will make you successful no matter what. That is the key to anyone who's ever had success.
It's about having a teacher or a mother like Christine Barnett. Because that's what you did, meaning, you know, it's one thing to say it, but you actually did it. Now, at 30 years old, you actually had a stroke. You were dealt some hand of cards. How did that stroke, how severe was it, how did it affect you, and where are you now in the recovery process?
So I was diagnosed with lupus, and lupus, I'm just going to tell you, for anybody going through it out there, it's not fun. It's not a fun disorder. At 30, I was making eggs for Christmas breakfast, and I was holding a carton of eggs, and suddenly that carton just felt very, very heavy. And I thought to myself, I'm going to have to sit down to make these eggs. So I pulled over a chair, sat in it, and didn't really feel any pain or anything like that, but I couldn't get back out of it. And it took me about 6 to 9 months to get movement fully back in one half of my body, which is the left half. And I had to depend a lot on my husband through those times. But I did regain, you know, I'm fully functioning now, just a little weaker. I mean, like, thankfully my boys are turning to teenagers, so they'll carry heavy packages for me and stuff like that. But yeah.
Oh, I'm glad that you're on the mend, because we can't let you go. How does Jake keep his Superman extraordinary gifts away from people when he first meets them? Does he talk about it, or does he just act like the normal 15-year-old?
Well, I think the thing he's learned in life is, you know, you got to meet people where they're at. So for me, that's been really difficult, because to try to meet my son now at quantum field theory is pretty much impossible, but I still sit and listen to him talk about the lectures. And I think, you know, when he meets people, he wants to find out who they are, and just he meets everybody where they are. And so that's a wonderful thing about Jacob.
Well, he sounds like an amazing child in so many ways. He enrolled in college actually at 11, scoring 170 on the entrance test. And from my understanding, 150 was the mark of a genius. What schools actually tried to recruit him, and where did he end up?
He had lots of schools been interested in him. So Princeton, Cambridge, Stanford, some of the very best schools were interested in Jacob, and I was lucky to have written this book, so I was able to take him around with me on this book tour that I did. And he could look at all the schools and think about them and make his decision. And when we came here to Perimeter Institute in Canada, we walked into the building and we saw people writing equations on the windows. We saw the equations spilling over onto the blackboards. And what was at this school that we didn't really necessarily see anywhere else was a passion for science that mimicked his. And so he immediately felt at home here. And it's just a wonderful place where there's creativity and collaboration. And it happens to also be one of the best places, I think the best place, for theoretical physics in the world.
Amazing. Absolutely amazing. How did a few nights of him not sleeping result in a astrophysicist saying that he actually might win your son the Nobel Peace Prize? the Nobel Prize, not Peace Prize.
At 10 years old, my son just, wasn't going to sleep. We actually took him in to get an EEG done, and they said, there's nothing wrong. He just isn't, he's just thinking. So he had stumbled across something in physics that just didn't make sense to him. And he tried to solve it. And after a while, he came up with what he thought was a good solution. And then he spent the next little bit of time trying to actually disprove himself. He went a little bit crazy trying to disprove himself. He got whiteboard markers out and he drew on every window of our house, inside and outside, underneath of the glass tables. And I got really concerned about what was going on. And I said, Jacob, are you stuck on something? Let's call somebody and see if they can help you. So I asked him who would know. And he said, Mom, I just don't think anybody's going to know. And finally, he settled on a professor at Princeton at the Institute for Advanced Studies. And I called and explained the situation. The professor said, oh, it'll be really, really easy to disprove him. Don't worry. I mean, he's a little boy, so people come up with theories all the time. Having an original theory, it just really doesn't even happen anymore. Don't worry. Just send it to me, and I'll get him back out to the playground. So I sent him the theory, and it took a couple days to get back to me, I think. And when the professor did, he said, Mrs. Barnett, what your son is working on is one of the toughest problems in theoretical physics today, and please, please, please don't send him to the playground, because what he has, in fact, done is create an original theory, which very likely could lead to a Nobel Prize someday.
Amazing. Absolutely amazing. And I'm fascinated by it because it really has to do with Jake is who he is because of not only the gifts that he have, but the gifts that you developed within him. He could never have been the person he has become without you. You know, and I love the entire story. If Jake was born a absolutely normal child who was not ever autistic and just, you know, grew up like any other teenager, would you trade that for who he is today?
Absolutely not.
See, I knew that answer, Supermom. Okay, but I had to ask it. You know what? I could go on and on forever. Unfortunately, we have to cut, but this was a fascinating interview. And I probably at one point would like to pick up on and interview Jake at another time, if that would be okay with Jake.
He would love to do that. Thank you so much for offering that. I'm sure he would love to talk to you.
Excellent. You are wonderful. I can't wait, you know, to let everyone know in the world they should read your book. And I look forward to watching on TV the Nobel Prize be given to your son.
So
have a wonderful, wonderful day.
You too. Thank you so much.
Oh, you're welcome. I want once more to thank Christine Barnett, Supermom, for coming on our show. Go to Amazon.com and you must pick up a copy of her phenomenal book, The Spark, A Mother's Story of Nurturing Genius. I am Dr. Errol Gluck. Remember, to every problem, there is a solution. You want to check out our other episodes. There is something for everyone, and some of these episodes, just like this one, will keep you on the edge of your seat. Go to Gluck Radio, G-L-U-C-K radio.com. We have some fantastic shows in our catalog and even more fantastic ones coming up. Till next time.